It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here for the first time in a while. We've got questions and answers. Steve's going to answer a whole wide-ranging list of topics. But before we do that, we've got security news, and he's going to talk about the VeraCrypt audit. Very good news for people who want to find a replacement for TrueCrypt. Stay tuned. It's coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 582, recorded Tuesday, October 18th, 2016. Your questions, Steve's answers, number 241. Security Now is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/securitynow. And by Carbonite. Keep your business safe this year. Protect files on your computer or server with automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free without a credit card at Carbonite.com today. Use the offer code SecurityNow to get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy. And by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to Audible.com/SecurityNow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest security news and help keep you safe and then explain how things work. And it's all done by this one fellow right here, the hardest working man in podcasting, Steve Gibson of the GRC Company. Hey,
yo,
Steve.
Great to be with you. So we don't have a lot of individual pieces of news. We're going to do a Q&A this week just because there's a bunch of fun stuff that our listeners have submitted, thoughts and observations and questions in some cases. But there were a couple significant stories, and the one that just burned up my Twitter feed was the announcement of the audit results from VeraCrypt, which of course is the successor to TrueCrypt.
I was thrilled that they audited it so quickly.
Yes, yes.
Because we went years without an audit for TrueCrypt.
Yes, and it's a consequence of the OSTIF, which is a small organization, and I can't remember what the acronym is for, but I have it in my notes. We'll get to it. Open Source Technology Improvement Fund.
Oh, I like it.
And so they generated the funding and then contracted with a French security firm who put two people on it. They spent 32 man days, and I thought, okay, well, that should be probably person days, in order to go through it. But the depth of their analysis is really informative, as is what they found. There's also, that we'll talk about, some concerns, a new big concern about biometric authentication problems. And you missed a story that I had some follow-up for that I wanted to make sure you were aware of, where web browsers turn out to be fatiguing SSD main storage on systems. A ton of miscellany, including we need to address the question of whether we're living within a simulated reality.
How have we missed that one? That's a,
and then a Q&A. Well, because it happened since you and I talked last with Elon going on the record saying, yeah, I think there's probably only maybe a 1 in billion chance that we are not in a simulated reality. Yeah. So anyway, it turns out that a lot of the popular press completely misunderstood what he meant, because the only thing that we are aware of sort of popularly is the Matrix. And he's not referring to that model at all.
Ah,
so
I
thought it'd be fun to discuss that. So
I'd love to.
Lots of fun stuff this week.
Well, before we get to the news, we got a mention of our fine sponsor. I love this company. They advertise on our shows because they know you guys are geeks, and they're trying to reach people who would like, for instance, to refinance their home entirely online or get a loan entirely online. I'm talking about Quicken Loans. They've created a product they call Rocket Mortgage. It's it brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. It's entirely online. They've taken all the complicated, time-consuming stuff out of applying for a mortgage. If you are done searching through stacks of old files and paperwork, dragging it into the office, having the loan, you know, manager looking at it all and stamping it, and then thumbing through pages and pages of loan rates to find something that roughly approximates your interest and need, you'll love Rocket Mortgage. You can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button. You'll get approved very quickly, almost instantly, and it'll be not a one-size-fits-all loan, but a loan that fits your particular needs, your unique financial situation. I love the little movie they have on the Rocket Mortgage site. Shows a couple looking at a house, liking it, and saying, okay, well, we're going to apply for the loan right here. Just hold on a second. And she does it on her phone, and boom, she's got it. That's pretty sweet. Rocket Mortgage is a quick online process you can manage from the convenience of your couch or at that open house. Right now, if you're looking to refinance or buy a home, go to quickenloans.com/securitynow. quickenloans.com/securitynow. The fastest, easiest way to apply for a loan. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states and MLS. ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. We thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. Go to quickenloans.com/securitynow. Steve doesn't need a mortgage. How long have you lived in your house?
1984. I paid it off quite a while ago.
Oh, my goodness. That's nice. That must actually be a nice feeling. We're working to pay off our house.
And also, Prop 13 is nice to have because, of course, that means that the base tax rate is really low. I bought it for $185,000.
Whoa!
Back then.
You couldn't get a potting shed for that anymore. It's not, no. Not in your neck of the woods, for sure.
No.
Wow.
So this is my second edition of the famous book that is often referred to as the K&R text. I'm holding up in front of the camera for our listeners. This is the book, The C Programming Language. And I looked around for my first edition copy, which is about half the thickness of this one. Even so, very thin by any standards of modern programming languages.
It's funny, I have both the first and second as well, and I keep the second here.
Yep.
And the first at home.
So I've reread the preface so many times because I just get goosebumps, and I've referred to it on the podcast a few times. Just the first paragraph reads, C is a general-purpose programming language which features economy of expression, modern control flow and data structures, and a rich set of operators. C is not a very high-level language, nor a big one, and is not specialized to any particular area of application. But its absence of restrictions and its generality make it more convenient and effective for many tasks than supposedly more powerful languages. C was originally designed for and implemented on the Unix operating system on the DEC PDP-11 by Dennis Ritchie. And he passed away.
5 years ago.
What?
I saw all this social...
What?
Yeah, he passed away the same week Steve Jobs did. No, you fell for it, and I almost fell for it, too.
How weird.
It was all over Twitter and Facebook that he had passed away.
Yes, and I got sucked right into it.
But if you click the link, there's a date on it, 2011. But nobody looked at that. So, yeah, he passed away when Steve Jobs did. In fact, one of the reasons I remember...
Now that you say it, I remember.
Yeah, because people were saying, everybody's making a big deal about Jobs dying. Nobody's saying anything about Ritchie passing away. Yeah. So anyway, but what? You know what? We deserve a tribute to Dennis Ritchie. 5 years later or 100 years later, this was a great man and wrote not just this, but much of Unix. So
yeah, he and Brian Kernighan.
Yep. K&R, they call this.
Yep.
And, you know, I actually haven't read the second edition, but the first edition, my first edition, is well thumbed.
Oh, it's just what I love about it is that it is so lean.
Yeah,
it's just
it's very
you know,
simple.
Of course, it appeals to me as Mr. Assembly Language.
It's as close to assembly language as you can get in a high level language.
And many people shared with me a photo of the week, which I just got a kick out of. And so this is the you're doing it wrong in a simple picture. And so this shows a password field, which is highlighted in red because the system's not happy. And it's saying password is used by another user.
It's
like, So count the number of things that must be wrong with a system that is able to tell you that. Now, it's true that it could be checking the hash, and we know that hash collisions are for reasonable size passwords are going to be very rare. But why would a system check the hash? So what it's clearly doing is looking up a user's record with the password as the index, and it finds an existing one and says, we can't have two users cannot use the same password because then our index will return two records, and we can't have that happen. So, I mean, it just is mind-blowing that somebody could say, that password is in use. Well, now, of course, that also begs the question, I wonder who's using it, because, of course, it's an information leak as well. So, I mean, bad architecture, fundamentally flawed, account management is just horrendous.
And we should add, if you ever see this, you should never ever see it for two. Not only that, but because it means you have a crap password.
Very good point.
Right?
If your password has collided with somebody else,
you've done a bad job, my friend. You got to stop using Monkey 123.
That's a perfect point.
You should never ever see that image.
So anyway, thank you everybody for sending that to me. That was wonderful.
It's pretty hysterical.
And we've got super astute listeners who, following along. Yeah, they got it.
Yeah.
So first story was covered by Forbes. And I'm looking now at the date to make sure it's recent.
And by the way, this is a lesson for anybody who snarkily says, right after I said that to you, I pulled up your show notes because I was going to show the image, and it didn't match what you were saying. I thought, well, this is strange. Then I realized the show notes I had were from 2011. So somehow 2011 is back, baby. Now I have the real show notes up.
So anyway, Forbes' title is rather brutal. Feds walk into a building.
Oh, yeah.
Demand everyone's fingerprints to open phones.
No.
And so I'm just going to read the top of the story. And two well-known legal experts were consulted for their opinion. So Forbes wrote, in what's believed to be an unprecedented attempt to bypass the security of Apple iPhones, although actually the warrant specified four different brands all known to have fingerprint readers. So the law enforcement officials didn't even know which phones people might have.
Wow.
So they just blanketed it. I mean, that's the big concern. Not only is there a concern with forced use of biometrics, which the argument has been is not constitutionally protected, but in this case, it's also just the breadth of this warrant. The security of Apple iPhones or any smartphones that uses fingerprints to unlock. California top cops asked to enter a residence and force anyone inside to use their biometric information to open their mobile devices. Forbes found a court ruling dated May 9th, 2016, in which the Department of Justice sought to search a Lancaster, California property. But there was a more remarkable aspect of the search. As pointed out in the memorandum, quote, authorization to depress the fingerprints and thumbprints of every person who is located at the subject premises during the execution of the search and who is reasonably believed by law enforcement to be the user of a fingerprint sensor-enabled device that is located at the subject premises and falls within the scope of the warrant, unquote. The warrant was not available to the public, nor were other documents related to the case. According to the memorandum signed off by U.S. Attorney for the Central District of California, Eileen Decker, the government asked for even more than just fingerprints. Quote, while the government does not know ahead of time the identity of every digital device or fingerprint, or indeed every other piece of evidence that it will find in the search, it has demonstrated probable cause that evidence may exist at the search location and needs the ability to gain access to those devices and maintain access to search them. For that reason, the warrant authorizes the seizure of passwords, encryption keys, and other access devices that may be necessary to access the device. Legal experts were shocked at the government's request. Marina Medvin of Medvin Law said, quote, they want the ability to get a warrant on the assumption that they will learn more after they have a warrant. Essentially, they are seeking to have the ability to convince people to comply by providing their fingerprints to law enforcement under the color of law because of the fact that they already have a warrant. They want to leverage this warrant to induce compliance by people they decide suspects later on. This would be an unbelievably audacious abuse of power if it were permitted. And then Jennifer Lynch, who's the senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, added, it's not enough for a government to just say, we have a warrant to search this house, and therefore this person should unlock their phone. The government needs to say specifically what information they expect to find on the phone, how that relates to criminal activity, and I would argue they need to set up a way to access only the information that is relevant to the investigation. The warrant has to be particular in how it describes the place to be searched and the thing to be seized and limited in scope. That's why, if a government suspects criminal activity to be happening on a property, and there are, say, 50 apartments on that property, they have to specify which apartment and why and what they expect to find there. And then she concluded saying, we've never seen anything like this. Now, nobody really, because this is not public, nobody understands the details. But from our technical perspective, if we were to sort of reverse engineer what may explain this, you know, because I was thinking about like, okay, first of all, the concern is this is now what law enforcement, this is apparently law enforcement's maybe another test, but their reaction to the famous, iPhone fingerprint hack problem, where they're just saying, okay, fine, we're just going to, you know, since the courts have said a password constitutes self-incrimination, which is protected by the Constitution, we can't do that. But the courts have also previously said biometric information is not protected. So law enforcement just saying, okay, fine, we want specifically the warrant to include to give us the right to force anyone in this location to unlock their phones. So again, the generality of this makes me think it's tied to an IP address. That is...
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. They know it's this building.
Well, or this residence. Yeah. It was actually a house. And so they probably found some traffic which they believed represented, in whatever it was, criminal activity. They got the address from the cable provider or whoever provides internet service. So now they know that it is a device, and they just presume probably a cell phone, if not maybe a PC, but those don't tend to be locked the way mobile devices are. And so they wrote the warrant to give them permission when they get there to force everyone to let them look inside their phones, presuming that one of them will have been the end point of that electronic communication.
Yeah, wow.
Which in my mind doesn't excuse it, but it sort of explains like probably what was going on.
So then that begs the question, because all of us now, I hope, have fingerprint protected phones, what you should do. And it seems to me the easiest thing would be when the feds pound on the door, besides flushing all the drugs down the toilet, you'll want to turn your phone off, because at least all the phones I've used, iPhone and Google phones, once you turn it off, the fingerprint won't re-unlock it. You'll have to then enter your passcode, which they can't reasonably demand. I mean, they can demand, but not reasonably.
Right. That or call your attorney and impose a 48-hour delay.
Oh, there you go. And that'll
because that's the,
that'll do it
that's
too.
The other thing that, that will cause that to expire. So, yeah. Again, we're in some interesting uncharted territory. I will say that Apple seems to have solved with iOS 10 the problem of the fingerprint reader working too quickly. I hate this double staggered.
I have a fix for it if you want.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
I looked for
one. I do too.
I hate it.
So that's something new in iOS 10. And the reason I figured out why they do that, because a long press of the fingerprint opens Apple Pay. So they want you to be able to use Apple Pay. So what they've asked is that this, you have to unlock it and then press it again. But if you go into the accessibility settings, you go to settings, general accessibility, and then there's a home button setting, you can restore the original pre-iOS 10 behavior of it both unlocking and
goes right in.
Ugh, so it's in the home button settings of accessibility, not the general home button settings. You have to go into accessibility, but yeah, as is often the case, they hide the stuff you really want under accessibility. But
I always turn up the visibility to, because I don't like that whole color bleed through thing.
Right.
I get rid of the animation because
exactly.
I don't need things zooming up and down and all that.
Oh, but you're not going to get them the cool fireworks in the iMessage. All right. So here it is, accessibility home button. You have click speed, but you also have rest finger to open. And that if you turn that on, it restores the previous.
Oh, good.
You don't need to do the double step tango.
It's funny, too, because I mean, I liked being able to press a button and I'm in.
Yeah.
Now you kind of have to wait for it to say it, or you press it again, or it's just so aggravating.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad they have a workaround.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I want to take our listeners through what Quark's lab found when they did what could only be considered a really thorough audit of Veracrypt. I will step on the conclusion here and just say that you want 1.17, or is it 9? Let me look. 1.19. What these guys audited was 1.18. So most of the problems, but not all of them, are fixed. And I think one of the reasons that so many people sent links to me breathlessly is that, once again, the headlines in the popular press show, you know, big red warning flashing, you know, emergency upgrade right now. And nothing here was a real showstopper. We've been living with it as it has been for a while. But this is a perfect case for us on this podcast to take a look in detail at the nature of these sorts of problems. So, as I mentioned before, this came about as a result of a small group who call themselves OSTIF, the Open Source Technology Improvement Fund. And they sort of have three missions. One is to offer bug bounties to help improve code, direct code improvement through grants, and professional audits. And so due to the history of TrueCrypt and the fact that VeraCrypt took it under their wing and then have moved it forward, they felt it was time to give this thing some real scrutiny. So 10 weeks ago from around today, on August 1st, the OSTIF announced, OSTIF is proud to announce that we have come to an agreement to fully fund an audit of VeraCrypt using funds that were donated by DuckDuckGo and Viking VPN. We plan to hire Quark's lab to go over the code and search for vulnerabilities and backdoors. VeraCrypt is a crucial piece of open source software that can encrypt any storage medium with powerful and highly tamper-resistant encryption that greatly enhances the personal security of anyone who uses it. An audit of the code brings fresh professional perspectives and a deep analysis of the code to search for vulnerabilities. And it goes on like that. So basically, 10 weeks ago, this was contracted. And after they began, 32 man days later, we have results. So, okay, first of all, what was found? I would argue no huge showstoppers, but the devil's in the details, and we'll go over that. But they did find a handful of both old and new things that needed to be cleaned up. Most of these were weaknesses that could sort of theoretically be used in highly targeted attacks to compromise the target's privacy and security, but mostly they are things that fell out of the technical scope of coverage. That is, even TrueCrypt noted some problems and said, but that's somebody else's problem. That is, you know, this is not the kind of thing it's feasible for us to protect against. But there are some things that were feasible that we're still not protected from. So there are both troubles inherited from TrueCrypt in VeraCrypt, and then there were new troubles introduced by new VeraCrypt features. So, and it's funny too, because I mean, any of our longtime listeners, a lot of this will be very familiar because, you know, step by step over the years, as problems were found in TrueCrypt, we talked about it on the podcast and covered it in some detail. So as I was reading through the audit, I'm going, oh yeah, I remember that one. Oh yeah, I remember that one. So one problem was from TrueCrypt, their password-based key derivation function was not acceleration resistant. That is, they didn't use a so-called memory hard function like Scrypt. It was just an iterated hash. And we know from all of the work that's gone into minting Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies that you can apply, especially large-scale integration, to hugely accelerate those operations. So VeraCrypt was using VeraCrypt inherited from TrueCrypt iterations of either 1,000 or 2,000, which depended upon which hash algorithm was used and its usage, that is, whether you are mounting a volume within the system or booting essentially accepting a password to boot the system from an encrypted system partition. So The original iteration counts were 1,000 and 2,000. They are now, get this, 200,000 and 655,000. So way stronger. There's also an additional feature that VeraCrypt added but introduced a bug that we'll cover later, known as a PIM, in this case, a personal iterations multiplier. And that gives the user some additional control so that if they don't mind waiting longer at boot or mount time, they can specify a so-called personal iterations multiplier, which, as it sounds, allows you to dramatically multiply that even further. Problem is, turns out there was an overflow in the math for the dramatic multiplication, so that it ended up reducing the rounds count rather than increasing it when you thought you were getting more security. Whoops. Anyway, that was easy to fix and was fixed. There was also a problem from TrueCrypt that sensitive information might be paged out from the kernel stacks. So you've got a kernel driver where the encryption decryption is going on. It has to have an operating symmetric key present, which means that key is persistently vulnerable to exposure. If in a low memory situation, a page of the kernel gets swapped out to non-encrypted storage, your key might be there. So that's a concern. However, VeraCrypt, that was the case in TrueCrypt. VeraCrypt doesn't change it. They simply state that this will be a vulnerability unless the system partition is encrypted and the paging file is therefore written to an encrypted partition. So, and that's, again, you know, that's some protection. It means that the key won't be readable, but you really don't want the key to go out into the swap file, because that's potentially accessible too. In the details of this, they talked about the fact that, unfortunately, both of these programs, the original TrueCrypt and VeraCrypt, which, you know, inherits most of itself from TrueCrypt, has sensitive data scattered around. So it is very difficult to collect it all in one place. That's, as an aside, that's one of the things that I did very carefully from day one of the Squirrel client for Windows, is I created a protected memory region, and absolutely everything that matters is within one solid contiguous block. And I also arranged to lock it into memory, and the program is so small, there's no danger of it being swapped out, because programs all get a chunk of memory that isn't in danger of being swapped out. It's only if they get really huge, then they're at risk of having some of their pieces removed. So anyway, so this is a problem with trying to do sort of add-on security to an operating system after the fact. You are fighting some of the architecture of the system. And it tends to be an OS by OS thing too, because of course this is all multi-platform. And the auditors did acknowledge that this is a difficult problem to solve on a multi-platform system or a multi-platform solution, because it requires deep knowledge of not just one OS at, you know, down at the kernel level, but, you know, Windows and Mac and Linux, you know, wherever it's going to run, it's a significant implementation challenge. Another problem that they did fix, but that TrueCrypt inherited from, that VeraCrypt inherited from TrueCrypt, was the various uses of compression and decompression. TrueCrypt used and sort of forked some early zip and unzip libraries, which had known problems. And Veracrypt didn't change it until this audit brought that to the attention and said, you know, even though exploitation is unlikely, why keep using these known problematical libraries? So the idea would be that if it were ever possible for an attacker to manipulate what was being decompressed, then that could be used to create a buffer overrun and potentially execute some code under the attacker's control. So the reason this wasn't considered, I mean, oh, and I should mention, this was brought up in 08, so 8 years ago, and the TrueCrypt guys knew this and said, well, you know, again, this is sort of out of scope. So an example of an attack would be the recovery disk is compressed, and as is the boot code, because it has to be so small in order to get the system going. But it's unlikely the boot code could be manipulated. The recovery disk, though, could theoretically be manipulated by an attacker, so that when a user used their recovery disk, it would decompress, and it could, and if that had been, if the recovery disk had been modified, the decompressor could have an overflow induced in it that, for example, might write the user's password to some external location or some fixed location where the attacker could then access it. But the counter argument is, okay, on the other hand, if a bad guy has that kind of access, the ability to alter the recovery disk, then they could do a lot more than something as awkward as manipulating the decompression problem. So essentially the auditors were saying, this is bad, and we're trying to figure out why. But, you know, it's the kind of thing where, and we see this all the time in security, vulnerabilities that are not obviously exploitable initially, even when they're identified, oftentimes in the future, due to changing circumstances or processor power or whatever, suddenly they then become exploitable. So so the compression decompression has been fixed. We also talked about, and Veracrypt had fixed, and these auditors verified, and you'll remember this one, Leo, where TrueCrypt is written in C. And the authors were using the memset function, which basically allows, memset is a C function or a library function, which allows you to say, set the following block of memory to this value. And typically it's zero. And so you want to zero out or null a block of sensitive data, like the password or like the master key or something. I mean, and so secure systems are often having to have transient, highly sensitive data, but then, and they're often allocating it dynamically. So you say, give me a buffer, you ask the operating system for a block of memory, and it says, okay, here's a pointer to the block of the size you requested. You're then able to use that until you free it. That is, you essentially tell the operating system, I'm done using that block of memory. Thank you very much. So what the programmers of TrueCrypt did was they were careful, because they don't know what the operating system is going to do with the memory that they give back to it, they were careful to zero it, to write zeros across the buffer, then return it to the operating system, so that memory that might have had something sensitive didn't just go floating around and maybe available to somebody else. The C compiler, though, is, as one of its optimization strategies, is looking for things that don't do anything. And some clever programmer somewhere said, oh, look, this memory is being zeroed and then immediately returned to the operating system. Well, so it hasn't, there's no purpose to zeroing it. That must have just been a mistake. And so the C compiler optimized out.
You didn't want to do that.
Yeah, that serves no purpose. You've zeroed the memory and given it away. So does, you know, how
isn't
dumb.
That a funny error? Wow. Too yeah. helpful.
Yeah, so there is a secure zero memory function which doesn't have this problem. And so one of the early things that Veracrypt did was to switch over wherever memset was being used to this secure zero memory function, which doesn't risk being optimized to nothing by the compiler. And there were too many subtle TrueCrypt kernel driver problems fixed to mention that were fixed by Veracrypt over, you know, since it inherited TrueCrypt. And I won't go through them all. I mean, they were just a collection of little subtle things. But the takeaway is these guys, the auditors, really did a nice job. There's no way you could come away from this thinking, wow, this hasn't been scrutinized deeply. There was one that was sort of interesting where they found that the kernel driver was not checking access permission on behalf of the user requesting to see whether a file existed. Now the kernel, of course, can do anything. It's God of the local environment, but it has to respect access permissions. It has to enforce access rights permissions. In this case, that was deliberately left out by the TrueCrypt developers because they wanted the boot time. Or they wanted an unprivileged user running TrueCrypt to be able to determine whether there was boot code on the system that would be privileged. So the kernel driver was specifically allowed not to check access permissions. What was, again, found by a close examination. And you have to take an adversarial position, which is what these guys did, is that you could use that, you could leverage that as an information leakage, allowing anybody to probe the system for the existence of files for which they have no access. The system should say, you have no access. Instead, it says, yeah, that exists, or no, that doesn't exist. And so so this could be exploited for an information leakage problem. And this is an example of something Veracrypt had not addressed. And so these auditors, you know, brought that back to their attention and said, yeah, you know, you need to think about this. Also, the AES cipher, which is the de facto default cipher, has cache timing vulnerabilities if the chip it's on does not support the AES instruction set. Now, the mitigating factor here is that Intel has supported the AES instruction now for quite a while, and maybe really low-end chips or old chips might not have it, but mainstream strong desktop chips have had it for years. So if the hardware instruction assisted code is used, then there's no problem. But the system runs on processors without the AES acceleration instructions, and in those cases this software is not cache timing proof, which is something that these guys again found. One thing that we talked about in the past was that the TrueCrypt developers misused the cyclic redundancy check. CRC32 was never designed to function as a cryptographic integrity mechanism, and they kind of crossed the line. They use it that way, What it was designed for and what it's really good for is efficient error detection. But that's different than integrity mechanism. And the difference is it's intended to prevent accidents, not thwart attacks. And so as a consequence of the fact that TrueCrypt does and VeraCrypt has continued for the sake of backward compatibility, because unfortunately it's built into the volume headers and various signatures, and it's very small, which is one of and very fast, which are both reasons that they used it. The problem is it is subject to manipulation. So for example, from the CRC32 is used to mix the key files in. Remember that TrueCrypt introduced this notion that not only could you make the master key that you decrypt dependent upon a user-provided password, but you could also use a key file. The idea being that it's just going to be some file unknown to an attacker with presumably a lot of entropy, and why not just pour that in? Well, that would be nice if they had run it through a good hash. Unfortunately, they ran it through CRC32, which is explicitly not a good hash. You know, it's a horrible hash. It's not a hash. And so from a valid set of key files, it's possible to create another distinct one file, which will also mount a volume, which is something you really don't want. One of the properties of a hash is that it's not easy to compute, it's really, really, really hard to compute an outcome to figure out what to put in order to get something out. And so what that first example is that the CRC32 doesn't provide that same guarantee. It's also possible to create null key files. That is a big file that does nothing to modify the so-called key file pool. And it's even possible from given a set of key files that to remove the security brought by that set of key files, essentially to add another file that completely nulls the effect of all previous ones. Again, something you could never do if you were passing all this through a real hash function. And finally, from a known passphrase, it's possible to create a key file which removes the security provided by the passphrase. And again, this problem too has been known since 2008, for 8 years, but the TrueCrypt authors just decided they didn't feel this was a because it required prior knowledge of a secret or the prior manipulation of a machine. And so here's again, this is like, well, okay, yeah, but boy, if you just used a hash, then you wouldn't have these problems. And this is the kind of thing that, as we've seen before, that tends to come back and bite people downstream when some clever person figures out how to, you know, like how to use that special case in a way that just happens to fit their needs. Also, volume headers are, quote, authenticated, unquote, with CRC32, which is weak authentication. Mostly, it's just a means of for the TrueCrypt driver to validate that what it's being given is a TrueCrypt volume. But and so it's not clear why using CRC32 opens a vulnerability, but it just seems sloppy. Also, James Forshaw, who's with Google's Project Zero, he discovered, and we reported back when he did discover this, a pair of problems in the kernel driver. One was a drive letter symbolic link creation elevation of privilege and a lesser concern problem. Both have been fixed, and these auditors verified that. Here's an interesting one that I just really appreciated due to its subtlety. And again, that just shows you that these guys thought about the code, the auditors really thought about this. When booting from the when booting from a BIOS, and that could be either UEFI or traditional BIOS, it turns out the user's password length can be obtained. And we know that's not good, because that makes brute forcing substantially easier. You don't have to bother, if you know the password length, you don't have to bother with trying any shorter passwords or any longer passwords. So it doesn't make it instant, but it dramatically simplifies the problem. The BIOS saves keyboard keystrokes in a 32-byte, 16-character ring buffer. That it, essentially every key you press puts 2 bytes in the buffer, the scan code of the keyboard and its ASCII equivalent. And it's a ring buffer, meaning that and this is a common programming technique, when you get to the last word, the last 2 bytes, then when you go to the next one, essentially it wraps around to the beginning. It goes back to the start of the buffer. And so this is commonly done in programming. It allows you to sort of have the equivalent of an infinite buffer, as long as somebody is reading from the end fast enough to keep the front from wrapping around and overwriting the oldest data. So these buffers are managed with ring buffers are managed with a typically called a head and a tail pointer. The head is the pointer to the last entered character. And so when a new character gets entered, that pointer is advanced or wraps around to the beginning, and then the characters are written there. And then the tail pointer is the character next to be read by somebody requesting the next character from the buffer. So if the head and tail pointers are equal, that is, if they're essentially, that means that the reader has read everything that's available in the buffer. And so when another character gets pushed, the head pointer moves forward. And then if the software polls because it's looking for input, it notices that the head and tail are different, meaning that the head is moved further forward. So then the tail is advanced as characters are retrieved. Well, it turns out that the authors of this code, and it wasn't clear to me whether this was VeraCrypt in the beginning or the original TrueCrypt, but somebody recognized there was a problem, and they explicitly cleared the buffer. We know where that buffer is in the BIOS. It is in a universally fixed location in RAM, and so TrueCrypt zeros it. But they forgot to zero the head and tail pointers. Those are 2 words immediately in front of the buffer, that is at just at the lower addresses, and those are not being cleared, never have been, which allows an attacker to determine with mod 16, essentially, the length of the user's password. I don't expect many people are entering passwords longer than 16 characters. Maybe they are, in which case that would still give an attacker a clue. If it looked like it was 4 characters, it might have been 20 characters. So that would still allow them to hugely decrease their search space in brute forcing. And so these auditors picked up on this problem and said, the head and tail pointers are another little information leak that should be taken care of. The VeraCrypt guys added command line options to the TrueCrypt invocation. Unfortunately, you can give it the volume password. And VeraCrypt added support for smart cards. Smart cards require a PIN in some cases, and you can also put that on the command line. These auditors thought that was a really bad idea because there are systems, for example, command line stacks that would keep that separately in the system. So there you've got your potentially your TrueCrypt or your VeraCrypt volume password sitting in the past command line history stack and available to anyone who knows to look for it. So they've strongly objected to the provision of secure information like that on the command line. And one of the other problems is that VeraCrypt added four new non-Western cryptographic algorithms, three ciphers and a hash. And one of the ciphers and hash were Russian design. The cipher is old, dating back from the 1970s, called GOST-89. And while it has a very nice 256-bit key, its block size is only 64 bits. And just recently on the podcast, we've been talking about the inherent problem with 64-bit block ciphers. They don't allow enough permutations of the bits in order to be secure. And because the VeraCrypt guys apparently so much wanted to use this Russian-designed cipher, I guess for the sake of internationalism, I mean, there's nothing wrong with AES that everyone can use, which is a 128-bit block cipher. They created a sort of a CBC, a cipher block chaining variant to concatenate two 64-bit cipher iterations in order to sort of kludge 128-bit equivalent. Unfortunately, it turns out that many of the security guarantees of cipher block chaining fail when you always have a null initialization vector, which they had to have because there was no provision for having unique initialization vectors in this application. So the good news is the auditors understood all of that, and GOST 89 has been removed from VeraCrypt. There just wasn't a safe way to essentially backport an old cipher with a small block size. It was just a bad idea. So again, another reason why having lots of eyes on these problems is a good thing. And there were another bunch of problems I won't go into detail that the auditors considered as informational, you know, sort of things that should be cleaned up but weren't crucial. However, it is worth noting that the UEFI bootloader, I talked about the BIOS key buffer problem. It turns out that that may even be worse with UEFI driver. UEFI drivers maintain their own keystroke buffers, but unlike the BIOS, the buffer's internal address and location are not known. There's an API that you use, and there is no visibility past that API. So the console in API does offer a reset method, but there's no guarantee of what that does in any specific implementation. So, you know, it may be to empty the buffer, but emptying a ring buffer means setting the tail pointer to equal the head pointer. So that may be what reset does, is just align the two pointers rather than zeroing the memory. It's really feasible to imagine that that's all it does. And so it turns out that in examining the Intel developer kit sample code for UEFI, it turns out that the Intel sample UEFI console in driver calls int 16, which is the old BIOS ring buffer. And so it's added another layer of abstraction, but the fundamental problem is still there. And maybe it's got its own internal buffer. We don't know. So this is interesting because here's a collision of low-level operation at boot time before the OS is running, where we're relying on very old, I mean, like, you know, from day one of the IBM PC, that's where the BIOS first appeared and Int 16 appeared, and we had a, you know, the clanky IBM keyboard, and it had this 16-character buffer, and it's still there today. The problem is, back then, we weren't trying to boot TrueCrypt volumes, and so there was like no expectation that what was being typed in had to be super secure. And if it had to be, IBM published a source code for the BIOS, and so everybody knew where the buffer was. It never moved, and so you could zap it if you needed to. But now we've like moved several generations beyond that, and we're imposing requirements for security that the underlying architecture was never designed to explicitly support. And so it's a fundamental architectural problem rather than a mistake that anyone made. And I guess the only thing you could do would be to service the hardware yourself. But that's a problem that Spinrite has, for example. The reason it doesn't currently run on a Mac natively is the Mac doesn't have a BIOS. It uses a USB keyboard and emulates that. Spinrite, in one area of its code, assumes it's on a PC, and it does its own hardware keyboard reading because it needs some of the facility that provides. And so that's, for example, something I had to back off from when I was beginning to work on 6.1 in order to allow it to run over on a Mac without any problems. So not easy solutions. So the audit concludes, this audit, funded by OSTIF, required 32 man days of study. It shows that this follow-up of TrueCrypt is very much alive and evolves with new functionalities like the support of UEFI. The results shows that evaluations at regular intervals of such difficult security projects are not an option. When well received by the project's developers, they provide useful feedback to help the project mature. The openness of the evaluation results help build confidence in the product for the final users. And I think that's 100% correct. So essentially, these guys verified that many old problems had been found and fixed, and they looked carefully at the new things that had been added and found some problems that needed to be and have been fixed. GOST 89 was removed. The compression and decompression algorithms were replaced with secure zip libraries. That password length leakage and the buffers are being cleared to whatever degree is possible, and other bootloader vulnerabilities were resolved. So VeraCrypt is now at 1.19 and is even more Vera than it was before.
Sounds like it might even be better than TrueCrypt was. I mean, these were TrueCrypt flaws. So
yeah, I agree. Now, you know, it was never our sense that there was a critical gotcha in TrueCrypt. Right. But we did say, it was about a year ago, that I think it was when the Project Zero findings came out. It's like, okay, because it was a problem in the kernel driver. There was an elevation of privilege that any process in the system could leverage because there's no way to restrict driver access to a specific process. It was like, okay, and we said on the podcast, it's probably time to migrate. If you're setting up a new system, use VeraCrypt. Don't stay with TrueCrypt. It's a superset. And of course, moving forward, it's becoming more important to be able to have support for UEFI for modern hardware platforms. And VeraCrypt continues to do that. And TrueCrypt just won't do it at all anymore.
Yeah. I'm also pleased to see that it was audited so quickly in its life compared to TrueCrypt, which we used for years without really any audit.
Yes.
I think that's great. I mean, this is something a lot of people are going to rely on.
And if nothing else, the as I said, this just overwhelmed my Twitter feed because so many of our listeners said, wow, okay, what does this mean? And so it's obviously of huge interest to people. And, you know, I'm probably fine with BitLocker because I don't have
Microsoft's solution.
Exactly. Microsoft's built-in solution where it's available. It's not available on all platforms, not the lower-end platforms.
Yeah.
But I fully understand that there are people who like the idea of a third-party solution and one that is open and have received this kind of scrutiny. This is what this kind of software needs. Okay, so what we talked about, I don't remember which of the 3 weeks it was, Leo, when you were away and Father Robert and I were doing the podcast, was it came to light that both Firefox and Chrome are frantic about taking snapshots of the current browser tab space constantly. And to the tune of gigabytes redundantly written to the system drive per day. And in fact, if you take the write endurance of an SSD and that is like the amount of that you write to it per day over its life, leaving Firefox or Chrome open, even on a idle system, can be consuming half of the total write life of the SSD. So one of the things that we talked about the first time this came up was that Firefox does offer a tweakable setting under about:config. And we talked about that little amazing zone of configuration many times, but you put about:config in the URL and then you need to use a search term because there's so many options, but browser.sessionstore.interval is the item, and it's a in number of milliseconds per refresh. It defaults to 15 seconds. And what it must be doing, and this is what's sort of disturbing, is that apparently they just didn't try to optimize this at all. If they had done any optimization, they would, for example, ask the question first, has anything changed in the last 15 seconds? Apparently they don't. And so they just take a snapshot of the entire context of the browser and write it to your down into your session profile. And not only Firefox, but Chrome does the same thing. In fact, I think Chrome was even writing a little more. This was of huge interest to many people. I have an SSD-based laptop, and you know, we know that the Windows 7 machine that I recently built, it has an SSD as its system drive with spinning drives in a RAID as backup. And so I am absolutely going to do what I think is a better solution, and that is, at least for Firefox, and I haven't explored this for Chrome, but for Firefox, under Application Data, Mozilla Firefox directory, there's a profiles.ini. And it's a short little INI file, about 7 lines. And one of the lines is relative. You need to set that from a 1 to a 0. And then there's a path where you can specify where these profiles are written. Just change that to a spinning drive. That is one that, not your system C typically, SSD, but you know, I normally use Z or something, or, you know, if, like something at the other end of the alphabet as my as my archival storage. And so I will, by all, I mean, absolutely create another non-write fatigable place for my browsers to write their profiles. And I will also hope that they get smarter about this, because it's just crazy how much data that they're writing constantly.
I'm surprised, given that almost everybody at Google, presumably a Mozilla too, is probably using computers with SSDs.
Yeah.
That they haven't fixed this. I'm sure they will.
Yeah. It sort of feels like it just didn't come up. They, you know, the architecture's been there since before SSDs, and until somebody pointed it out, what happened was that they used the Mark Russinovich's Process Explorer. And so anyone could do this, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. You just run Process Explorer, and under the view item, there are you know, columns. You're able to turn on more columns in the display, and there's disk I/O. You go to that tab, and then it's bytes read and bytes written. You turn both of those on, click OK, and that adds those columns to the display. And if you just sit there watching it, you just see Firefox or Chrome just going crazy. And so, you know, my immediate reaction, although I'm on spinning drives on this old system of mine on a RAID, was to just slow it down by a factor of 10. I added a zero. It was 15,000, meaning 15,000 milliseconds. I made it 150,000. So instead of every 15 seconds, it was every 150 seconds. But a better solution is just move it to somewhere else. And if you don't have a somewhere else, like, for example, on this nice laptop that I've got that is SSD, I think I may go back to the days of a RAM disk, because it's got a ton of RAM. So I'll just create, you know, a D: RAM drive and have the profiles live there.
You'd think that the controller and the caching software would handle all this and not, you know, not pass it on directly to the hard drive.
Well, but anything you so it could if it was reading it, but the problem is it has a write-through cache.
Right.
Yeah, because the whole point is, if the browser crashes or hangs or the system crashes, you want to be able to restore your session. So this is all just session restore. But boy, what a cost. Again, has to be because they just didn't give it any attention. And I'm hoping that by, you know, now that this has come to light, that somebody will, you know, spin off a little side project and get busy and fix this. I'm going to drink some coffee. Why don't you...
Good timing.
Who's bringing the podcast?
Good timing, my friend. I didn't want to interrupt your flow, but excellent time to talk about Carbonite online backup. See, hard drives, as we know, and Steve knows better than most, fail. And they fail for a lot of reasons. They could fail because your browser is writing a little too much to the cache, or because there's a fire or a flood or a typhoon. There's lots of reasons you could lose your data. And the worst case, a fire, a flood, or a typhoon, or an earthquake, would lose not only the data, but all the backup in the same premise, right? And a lot of people, that's their only backup solution. That's why I really recommend, Steve always has two, offsite backup. And it's why Carbonite is such a great solution for people in business, people at home, people who have data that they don't want to lose, they can't afford to lose. And they that maybe you even have a great backup strategy, but you don't have that one key thing, that off-site backup. Carbonite is automatic cloud backup. It happens, it's automatically. You don't have to think about it. And it happens whenever changes are made. So it's continuous as long as you're online. And it's backing up to the Carbonite cloud, the network servers, where your data is relaxing on vacation in their climate-controlled facilities. Your data even gets back. Carbonite even backs up your backups. So it's really, really safe. You can look at your data anytime, too. You can watch it. It's kind of like when you get a puppy sitter, a dog sitter, and they have the little camera in there, and you can look at your puppy while you're on vacation. You can check your on-vacation data. Just go to Carbonite on any computer, log into your account. There's your stuff. It's just, you know, it's really, it's like cloud storage too, right? You can even use their free apps on your phone or your tablet and download or email your data. So you get cloud storage plus backup. And of course, should the worst happen, including ransomware, really got to emphasize that. Because Carbonite does versioning on Windows, you can even, if you're, you know, you got hit by ransomware, and I know nobody listening to this podcast would ever get hit by ransomware, but maybe your friends or family might. Then even if they don't do, like, they call you, they wander off, and your backup, your data gets backed up, encrypted, Carbonite, because you can go back in time to a previous version, you've always got a good version waiting for you. 500 billion files backed up so far. More than 1.5 million homes and offices use Carbonite. Windows or Mac, from spreadsheets to emails, Carbonite online backup. Go to the Carbonite website. Pick the plan you want. You could try it free right now. You don't even need to give them a credit card, which means, you know, it's really free. You don't have to worry about it. If you do decide to buy, the more you buy, I think that you can buy a year or even more, the bigger the discount you're going to get. Up to 30% on multi-year subscriptions. And when you do the trial, please use our offer code, SecurityNow. You see right there on the front page. Just type in SecurityNow. That way, of course, Steve will get credit, which is important. But also, you'll get a reward 2 months free with your purchase. Starts at $59.99 a year, billed annually. That's less than $5 a month for everything on a Mac or a PC. Carbonite.com. Use the offer code SecurityNow for 2 months free with purchase. Steve has now imbibed caffeine and is prepared to continue on.
Oh, and I need a little caffeine for this one. So the setting is the Recode Code Conference 2016. Elon Musk is on stage with interviewers Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher, taking questions from the audience. Josh Topolsky, who's a co-founder of The Verge, in the audience, asks Elon whether he thought we might be living in a simulation. We immediately learned, to our surprise, that Elon has ruminated about and hashed through this topic so thoroughly already that he and his brother have formally banned its further discussion anytime they are in hot tubs. Its discussion is formally banned from hot tub debate. And he was dead serious about this. So in answering the questionnaire, Elon put a number to it and even like worked through his logic, concluding that he believed we are indeed living within a simulation. And he says, in fact, he thinks there's only probably about a 1 in a billion chance that we are not simulated and are living in what, that is, a 1 in a billion chance that we are living in what he refers to as a base reality. So it turns out that this is, and maybe Josh knew this already, because Elon was on record, at least for a couple years, back in 2014 at Vanity Fair's 2014 New Establishment Summit. Elon made the case that our lives are not at all what we think they are. He concluded, again, even back then, there's a 1 in a billion chance that this is reality. And so he said, for example, quoting him from this Recode conference recently, he said, "The strongest argument for us being in a simulation is the following. 40 years ago, we had Pong, two rectangles and a dot. Now, 40 years later, we have photorealistic 3D with millions playing simultaneously. If you assume any rate of improvement at all, then the games will become indistinguishable from reality. It would seem to follow that the odds that we're in base reality is one in millions. Anyway, so I thought, okay, so that's interesting. Now, a lot of the press jumped on the Matrix, which, and what I realized was that, okay, that's sort of the pop version of what this sort of sounds like, but it's not what Elon means. So the difference is the Matrix, we can think of, everyone knows the movie, of course, we can think of it as sort of a, you know, an MMO, right? Massively multiplayer environment where you are sort of a reflection of yourself in this other environment. What Elon is referring to is different than that. He's referring to more something like the game of life. Of course, Conway's famous game, where you have rules by which these little cells are born or live and die, and those rules create this surprisingly rich result. And so what Elon is meaning is that everything, you know, what we regard as reality could be running in some sort of a reality support container, meaning that life are an emergent property of that. So it's not that we exist as ourselves outside of this, as was in the case with the Matrix, but in fact that reality as we know it is something that we perceive from inside, but that it exists in some sort of a container. And Leo, I heard you talking about it, I guess, over the weekend. And there was some conversation about, you know, continuity, like the continuousness of space. And what is a little creepy is that it turns out the most recent theories of space-time is that it is quantized. That is, photons do not travel continuously at the lowest level. They are jumping from one essentially pixel, for lack of a better word, to the next. So that's kind of creepy. Anyway, I thought that was a kick and wanted to stick it into the podcast. When I was trying to think of like an example of this, Star Trek followers will remember in the Next Generation series, the creation of Professor Moriarty on the holodeck, where Data wanted Data was role playing essentially as Holmes and Sherlock Holmes, and asked the computer to create a rival worthy of Holmes in the form of Professor Moriarty, and a conscious entity was created. I think it was entitled "Ship in a Bottle," I think was the title of the episode. And everybody felt bad about having created this consciousness that apparently did exist, but they ended up giving him his own reality, which would continue running. So at least he'd be happy in his little world that was all, all a program.
Cool stuff. There you go.
So, a little quickie on the lithium ion battery issue. And Leo, I know you've been interested in this. I've got two pictures. And I found a guy, thanks to a follower who pointed me at a link, and I followed it down. There is a company, QNovo, QNovo.com. The guy there has a blog, and this person is in the middle of this battery technology. For example, the most recent blog posting is titled "The Perils of 4.4 Volts." Before that, "The Real Science Behind Battery Safety." Before that, "It's Easy, But Not Right, to pick on Samsung. Before that, making sense of 100 kilowatt hours. And for example, there, I picked up on this because it mentions Tesla. He says, Tesla Motors announced today upgraded versions of the Model S and X boasting 100 kilowatt hour battery packs, up from 90 kilowatt hour used in their earlier top of the line electric vehicles. 100 kilowatt hours sounds like a lot, and it is. But I bet that many readers won't have an intuitive sense of this amount of energy. This is what this post is for. Anyway, this guy, to sum up, and I've got links in the show notes for anyone who wants to dig in more, or you just go to qnovo.com and you'll find at the top in the menu a link to his blog. And it's really good stuff. He explains that the problem is that these batteries are experiencing is the formation of lithium metal crystals, which due to a combination of physical manufacturing problems and pushing the batteries as hard as we do these days, can force the lithium crystal to grow through the insulator and create a lithium bridge between anode and cathode. Then you have a short circuit and the battery dumps its energy into itself essentially and explodes. And so one of the things, and this is well understood, but the solution for this is to guarantee that the cathode is physically smaller than the anode. That is, the edges of the anode extend beyond the cathode. And that simple physical property prevents the formation of these crystals. The problem is, or mitigates the problem, but that extension, while it creates a safety margin, it does not store energy. So in the pressure to get the energy storage as high as possible, the manufacturing engineers have cut the margins. And so you can imagine the pressure on battery makers for their batteries to, I mean, there's like that is the pressure, is we want them to charge fast, and that's dangerous, and we want to charge high, that is right up to their maximum voltage, because if we aren't charging it as high, we're not putting as much energy in. And so the combination of speed and extent of charging, then weakened by this loss of margin in the oversizing of the anode, ends up creating the catastrophe. And so his point is, Samsung was only the first to get bitten. And of course, remember years ago, he says 15 years ago, laptops were having this problem because there were problems with laptops back in the day. And as we talked about a couple weeks ago, the last Christmas, the hoverboards were catching fire and exploding. So it's a problem, a combination of manufacturing and that we're pushing the margins. We have pushed the safety margins out in this quest for storing ever more amount of energy in a smaller space, and wanting quick charging, which is challenging as well. So I just wanted to kind of end that topic, follow up on it, because I found this terrific site. I did want to briefly mention that I spent some time this weekend and made a major update to the Healthy Sleep Formula page with a complete dosage determination protocol. Many people have been reporting success, but they just didn't have any guidelines for determining how much of what they should take. And I realized that I'd had enough feedback from people, enough experience myself and interacting with enough people, that a step-by-step protocol had emerged that would allow anybody to move through it in order to set the dosage for themselves, because we've also learned that there's a range of dosage. So for many people, for who say, hey, I tried one of each and it didn't work, it's like, okay, well, you need to do a little more work. The problem is we're all so different in the way, both in the way we sleep, why we don't sleep, and how sensitive our bodies are to being pushed away from where they would normally be by supplements, that everybody needs a different dosage, and there's nothing you can do except work it out for yourself. So I provide that.
I ordered mine. Got my oleamide.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so I'll try that now.
Good.
Does it come with a micro scoop?
Yeah, it does.
But yeah, you take 20 micro scoops worth.
Yeah.
So yeah, I use a tablespoon or something, right?
Well, and actually the page has a picture of the microscope. It shows that the microscope, a level microscope, is 50 milligrams. But then you can get for a couple bucks, standard measuring spoons. And so I've used them and weighed them to determine how many milligrams of weight each different measuring spoon is. And so the 1/8 measuring spoon is 500 milligrams. And so I do two of those.
Oh, okay.
So that makes it much easier.
That's a quarter, if my math may be correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I also wanted to follow up on this, what do we call a two-book series?
Yeah.
There was Trilogy, and you found that the reference to Bilogy, apparently duology is the formal noun for, as it described, a pair of related novels, plays, or movies.
Except it's not, and it's incorrect Latin. It's not an existing Latin usage.
Right.
Yeah.
And what I didn't explain is that it felt like there just must be a word that I had forgotten. Like, trilogy is so obvious. We all know trilogy.
Right.
What's the one for two? And it's like there really isn't one.
Isn't that funny?
I don't get it. It's just like, okay. I thought I must just be having, as they say these days, a brain fart.
Nope.
But no. Just isn't.
Isn't that weird?
There isn't a common word for two, and you would think there would be one that would be as familiar to us as trilogy.
Apparently not. But
no. A real quick note from Bob Port, who's in Albany, New York. The subject was how SpinRite kicks butt. And everyone knows what the story is going to be. He said, it finally happened. I knew it eventually would. A 5-year-old hard drive. Okay, so not very old. On a perfectly serviceable Dell Windows PC, started acting up. It was just getting old, like all of us always are. I downloaded your utility, SpinRite, and voila! My hard drive was back in business, virtually good as new. How simple can life be? My eternal thanks, Bob Port. And so, Bob,
nice.
Thanks for sharing your success.
Voila!
Voila. And I found myself when I was reading this, him talking about how simple it is. I've for years, many, many years, resisted adding this or that feature to SpinRite. Because, I could have taken the path of kitchen sink stuff. But what it does makes so much sense to just simply do what it does, which is just fix the disk. And in fact, it's interesting because recently when I was working with the beginning of the 6.1 project with a bunch of people online, I sort of suggested, what about, if in the next version of SpinRite, I add the Beyond Recall feature? And the community pushed back hard and said, no, make that a separate product. And we want SpinRite just to stay what SpinRite is. And it's like, oh, okay. So that's probably what I'll do. And in fairness, my plan in the future is, in fact, to recognize that things change with drives becoming so inexpensive now. I mean, it's just nothing to go get, a replacement hard drive. SpinRite's in place recovery was born back when nobody had a second drive. I mean, you weren't using them as doorstops. They were really expensive. It was the most expensive component in the entire computer. And so SpinRite fixed the one you had. 7 will evolve to doing things like, moving your data, being file system aware and pulling files that they specifically ask. Basically, in fact, adding all of those additional features that people have wanted over time, I'll have a good platform for doing that then.
Let's do a little audible thing, if you don't mind, and then questions and answers.
Perfect.
How's about that? Our show today brought to you by my audiobook seller of choice. It's not like there's much choice when you go to Audible. That's it. It's all there, baby. Everything, including the second book in Peter F. Hamilton's Dilogy.
That's so wrong.
Or whatever. People are saying sequel, but not a sequel, because that would imply that the first book was complete and written as a whole and then followed up. But this is something that was written, intended to be a two-book series. I don't know what you call it. Book 2 of the Chronicle of the Fallers is out, A Night Without Stars. My golly gosh. I've got it, Steve, and I haven't read it yet, but I love book 1. I can't wait to read book 2.
Yeah.
So this is the thing. I say read, and people get mad at me. I know. I'm not reading it. I'm listening to it. I'm listening to the amazing John Lee, who narrates all of Peter F. Hamilton's, or most of them anyway, books. Read it, and I tell you, it comes to life in your head. If you like sci-fi, for me, science fiction on TV or movies has always paled compared to the book, because your imagination is so much better at building sets and creating universes than... Yeah. I mean, how would you do justice to Ringworld, Larry Niven's amazing series, if you were doing a movie or TV show? You'd have to do a pale imitation of an actual Ringworld. But when you read it or listen to it, it comes alive. And I say listen better, because listening is amazing. It's somebody creating in your head. Let me find Ringworld here. Creating in your head this world. And it's like watching a movie in your mind. If you haven't read Ringworld, my golly, you gotta read it. And then the many, many follow-ups to it. And, of course, the books that Larry did with Jerry Pournelle as well. We've also often talked about those. Peter F. Hamilton, so many great books, and Audible has them. In fact, Audible has become the place for science fiction. And I think that's partly because they didn't have any when they first started. I've been an Audible subscriber for 16 years. When I started, I was really excited about listening to Heinlein and Asimov, and they didn't have a whole lot of it. I found other stuff to listen to, but I have to say Audible understood that that was a problem. They created the Audible Frontiers series and have re-recorded many of the classic science fiction novels from those great writers, including Frank Herbert's Dune series, and brought them to life. Now, we always recommend Fallen Dragon. That's the first Peter F. Hamilton book. It's a slim 26 hours and 30 minutes, but it's complete. It's not a dilogy.
Oh, it's so good. And it's just a perfect introduction.
But I've never been able to recommend it on Audible because it was never made as an audiobook. November 1st, Fallen Dragon comes out on audio. Big, big news. Meanwhile, there's plenty of other things to read, hundreds of thousands of titles in every arena. I mean, there's fiction, there's nonfiction, there's science fiction. I read a lot of history. This is my next, a brand new, I love World War II histories. This is an interesting one, kind of timely. The Ascent of Hitler from 1889 through the beginning of the Third Reich, 1939. Hitler Ascent, it's called. You could get this for free. There are so many wonderful books on Audible, and I just listen all the time. What we're going to do is we're going to set you up with the Audible Gold account. If you go to audible.com/securitynow, that's it. audible.com/securitynow. Your first month is free. That means your first book is free, because the gold subscription is a book a month. You also get the Daily Digest of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, so you can keep up on what's been going on in the news. And if you decide, it's not for me. I don't like movies in my mind. Don't worry. Don't worry. You cancel and you pay nothing. But that book will be yours to keep forever. So many amazing books. I'm just blown away by Audible. Audible.com/security now. The hardest thing is picking your first book. So many good books. V for Vendetta. Before I see a movie, especially sci-fi, I listen to the book because I want that movie in my mind first.
The book is always better.
So you finally come around to that, have you?
Oh, no.
You've always felt that way?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, when I know that a movie is on its way, I'll often read the book first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Girl in a Train. Supposed to be a great movie, but I'm going to read the – actually, I read the book. Fabulous. Read the book first.
Yeah, the Expanse series was like that. I heard that the Expanse series was coming, so I read the books first.
Yeah, you're smart. Although they did a good job with the TV show, didn't they?
They did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just, you know, I love history. This is one on my wish list. Mary Beard's History of Ancient Rome, SPQR. It's supposed to be amazing. Anyway, I can go on and on. I shouldn't. Just do it yourself. Audible.com/security now. Let those movies unroll. Spool out in your mind. They're so vivid.
Yeah, and it is the case. I agree with you completely that very often, although it's fun to see it, it does sometimes just not live up to our – well, in fact, I remember reading Jurassic Park before I saw the movie, and they left pieces out that I was just – I was so upset that they left out like some of my favorite parts. It's like, wait, you just skipped over what?
All the Michael Crichton novels are on Audible.
Yeah.
And that's a really – he's a cinematic writer. You can tell he's writing a book that's going to be a movie. And listen to Andromeda Strain. Oh, my God.
Or so Westworld. That's Crichton.
That's right. That's Crichton.
Yes.
There you go. Are you enjoying Westworld?
Oh, yes.
The problem is we want to talk about this stuff. We don't want to spoil anything.
It's delicious.
Yeah. It's I'm starting to feel like this is a rabbit hole with a long way down.
Oh darn! I think it's one of the best things HBO's ever done.
It's really good. It's quite engaging.
The production quality. They're not in a hurry. I'm not in a hurry. Let's just
That's what's really cool about these new serialized TV shows. It's not 2 hours in a movie. You really have the space to stretch out, and that
sometimes Game of Thrones can be a little.
Oh, I'm done with Game of Thrones. I know
stretchy.
I have to watch it. I'm so glad it's the last year, but
it was. I know the last two episodes last season were the only ones really worth anything. But for its own sake,
time to put it out of its misery. Winter is here. Okay,
yes,
not coming. It's here.
All right. And we have John doing car commercials now.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah, he's driving an Audi, I think, or a Lexus. I can't remember which brand.
No, but John Snow cannot drive an Audi.
It just shows him like kind of with a little appreciative look on his face as he likes the way the car performs. It's like, okay.
Lexus. It's a Lexus commercial.
Okay.
Nathan Hartley, our first question of the day today. Nathan Hartley tweeting, listening to 579, and would rather see a push to IPv6 with encryption enabled, kind of built in, for everything than just this push towards, you know, IPv4 with HTTPS. Actually, that echoes what the father of the internet told me. What's his name? You know.
Famous guy.
You know that guy.
Yeah.
The father of the internet. You know, Vin Cerf.
Vin Cerf. I'm glad you and I are of the same age.
You know, the dad.
Is he still alive?
He's a beautiful guy. Wonderful guy. Oh, beautiful guy. Still alive. Made me cry. Because we had him on Triangulation. We had a two-part series. But I asked him if you were doing it again.
Yeah.
He did TCP/IP. I said, if you're doing it again, what would you do different? He said, I put encryption in.
Yeah.
So this is a chance to go back and fix it.
Kinda. The problem is, and I've had many people ask, so I was glad that Nathan's question hit me at a time when it was time for a Q&A. What was part of the spec of IPv6 was called IPsec, IP security. And what it does is it formalizes, I mean, we already have IPsec, which can be used on IPv4 sort of as a higher level protocol. This puts it into layer three of the OSI 7 layer architecture. That is to say, IPv6 must support IPsec, as opposed to we're not sure if it's there or not. But the problem is, and nothing shows this better than the ecosystem surrounding HTTPS and all of its challenges, IPsec doesn't solve any of that. That is, it's a mistake to just say, let's just put security in. Because remember that what we're getting is two things. We're getting privacy, which from the encryption, and authentication. And the authentication means we're sure about who we're talking to. But that's a problem that IPsec doesn't itself solve, because there isn't a solution, in the same way that HTTPS doesn't itself solve it. Both those provide a carrier. They provide a possibility of solving it. They provide a substrate, but you still need all of that other gunk, which is so problematical. The whole, you know, in the case of HTTPS, we have certificate authorities and root trust stores and certificate chains and intermediate certificates and all and expiration and all that. So that's the best mechanism we've come up with for really employing HTTPS. IPsec is definitely useful for point-to-point sort of fixed connection applications. There is a good key exchange protocol, but it doesn't. It's not like just switching to IPv6 and suddenly everything is encrypted. And even if you were to employ, for example, opportunistic encryption, where you do create privacy, that still doesn't solve the authentication problem. Meaning that a man in the middle could still decrypt and re-encrypt unless you had end-to-end verification of who you were talking to. And so I've been looking for an opportunity to say, yeah, it's great that it's going to be there, but it's not like it's some miracle that allows us to avoid all of these other real bad or big and enduring and even getting worse problems that we see with HTTPS. All it does is it submerges it down into the lower level plumbing, and because it is bound into the spec, anything that says we support IPv6 inherently supports IPsec. Definitely good. So it's necessary, but it's not sufficient just by itself.
You know what we really need to do? We need to start a campaign. This is kind of off topic, but Google kind of did this HTTPS Everywhere campaign. And, you know, I think they've done probably a pretty good job of encouraging and Let's Encrypt supporting this HTTPS Everywhere. But, okay, that's good for security. But we need to do a campaign to end DDoS. And it's really a simple campaign just to get ISPs all over the world to block traffic that's not coming from IP addresses they own. Right?
I wish that were the case.
Oh, but now with these amplification attacks, does that mean?
No, because those are spoofed also.
Okay.
It's the in-band attacks. What the IoT devices are doing is issuing valid HTTP requests. So, and they don't care about being exposed. You know, some camera in someone's backyard doesn't, you know. And so if they lose that little bot,
that's the problem, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's that, unfortunately, just the IP spoofing, that would be a part of a good solution. But what's happened is we've moved now to just flooding sites with valid queries.
Right.
because now that
you can block it, you can't. There's so many IP addresses in there, it can be real. Because so what? You turn off that camera. There's 80,000 other ones.
Right. And so an ISP technically could see a ridiculous number of like redundant queries.
Well,
but that's a huge burden to place on them.
Yeah.
They would have to they would then be doing traffic inspection in order to look at every single query leaving and then making basically a value judgment. And you know, we know it's impossible to come up with a good porn blocker because it tends to misfire. It misses things and it blocks medical pages, for example.
Right.
So in the same fashion, it's just those sorts of heuristics just don't work.
Never mind.
But yeah.
Never mind. Dante Bertana. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Question two. I wanted another tweet. I wanted to let you know about Duck DNS, another free DNS or Dyn DNS. They even have copy-pastable guides to configure your own Pi OpenVPN server, duckdns.org.
Yeah, a number of listeners have referred to them. I've heard they got a great reputation. And, of course, we were talking about the idea of people running their own VPN endpoints where that made more sense than using a service. And so DuckDNS, I liked it also, as Dante mentioned, they explicitly support the little Pi OpenVPN server, which is a simple $35 way of just sticking a VPN server onto your existing router. And then this solves the problem of its IP moving around if you're away from home. You know, how do you find your IP if your ISP moves it? And Dynamic DNS does that, and DuckDNS provides it.
Is it DuckDuckGo? Is it the same people? Or another? Is it another duck?
I don't think they're related.
Might be Affleck. Dagan Henderson, you have said in the past, Steve, that forcing users to change their passwords regularly offers no increase in security. In fact, we've even said it might even reduce security.
Yep.
Because they'd be tempted to reuse passwords or use variants of old passwords or just make them easy and short. Easy to remember. But during Security Now 578, you said rotating encryption keys, DNSSEC, is considered good security practices. In both cases, isn't it just a secret being expired and replaced? Why is key cycling a good practice while password cycling is unnecessary?
So a great question. And as your comments, Leo, indicated, it is gray. There is no question. We know from experience that where corporations have forced their entire employee base to routinely change passwords, there is a huge back pressure from the people who the IT department are imposing this upon, to the extent that they'll, for example, game the system. They'll figure out that, oh, look, if I rotate among three, that fools it because it only keeps track of the previous two. And so I give it a third and that pushes the one that I'm giving it off the end of the little, you know, queue. Or they'll like deliberately use, you know, change it six times right away and then right back to the one they originally had. I mean, they don't want to do it. And so in the case of DNSSEC, though, it wasn't just for the sake of rotating keys. It was also the fact that they were going from a 1024-bit to a 2048-bit key. And so that's a ridiculously large improvement of security. And it's the kind of thing you explicitly don't want to have to do very often. So that their feeling was, since we're not an emergency, where everything's kind of quiet right now, we can schedule it, people can buy airfare and so forth for the meetings to come together, now would be a nice quiet time to do it. And the other reason is we've talked about the crazy security that process is surrounded by. Well, that also says you don't want to do it very often. It is the weak time when all that is happening, when this key change is occurring that's when the system is most vulnerable. So you want to do it infrequently. But then that also means you want to get as much value from that as you can. You want to get enough bang for the effort. So again, there isn't any sort of black and white. I do argue that changing keys seems more like a bad idea than a good idea, because the only argument that I can see for it is if there's a reason to believe old keys are compromised, and that's when we are changing passwords, right? When a service announces, oh shoot, we just lost half a billion of our subscriber accounts passwords, everybody has to change their password. So okay, there it makes sense. So what some people have felt is, okay, maybe we don't know of breaches which have occurred, so we're just going to preemptively force everyone to change their password. Wow, it's just that's an expensive thing to ask a large community to do. So it's a gray area, but I think it can easily be overdone.
Question, let's see here, 4 from a fella named Steve.
Not me.
Is that his real name? Hey, Steve, just finished your latest podcast. Still a highlight of my week. Quick note about Windows 7 update problems. I'm in a team that administers hundreds of Windows 7 machines and have found that if a Windows 7 machine has Service Pack 1 installed, simply stopping the update service, then installing Microsoft Knowledge Base Update 3.10.28.10 does the job every time. We run the WSUS servers and heaps of machines that we're not updating. The job was given to me. I made a group policy startup entry. It's just a batch file that checks to make sure Windows 7 is running, checks the architecture, then downloads the appropriate update. Windows actually has a built-in wget equivalent called bitsadmin. So the batch file stops when update service installs the update. It can still take a couple of hours for the machine to finally finish searching for updates the first time, but it has had a 100% success rate so far.
I really appreciate
that. What does that update do?
So that's the one that informs Windows of the change in the update service that Microsoft offers. So if you get a brand new, Service Pack 1 was the one and only service pack for Windows 7. So if you get a Windows 7 machine with SP1, which is the last image Microsoft made available, and you just say, you install it and you say go, well, as he said, and as all of our listeners who've tried this know, oftentimes days go by and nothing happens. Well, it turns out that since SP1, Microsoft changed the actual service. And so the Windows update back at the time of SP1 doesn't know how to contact Microsoft. The API was not done in a backward compatible fashion. So you stop the update service, install just this one update, and informs Windows 7 how to get the other updates from Microsoft. But the key here, and this is what's often missed, is manually stopping the update service. That's the key. Most people just sort of assume it won't be in the way, and so they try to install this update while the update service is running and there is a collision. So you stop the update service, then you install this, and then reboot your system. Update service will restart, and then it will move forward.
Kind of weird. Microsoft doesn't say anything about stopping it in the note about this, although they mentioned that svchost.exe, one of the symptoms is occupying 100% of CPU usage. is that the update service host.exe? I would guess that is, huh?
The service hosts a whole bunch of different services. Yeah.
Okay. So stop the update service. You know how to do that, right? And then apply this patch.
If you go under the admin tab, there's like a services, or you could click on. I'll never forget. It was Crazy Chris.
Perillo.
Perillo. Yeah. Exactly.
That's all you had to say was Crazy Chris. I know what you're talking.
Crazy Chris. You write. It was he, because I was new to whatever version of Windows it was. It must have been XP. And he said you right click on my computer,
select and properties,
and yeah. there. Well, actually
system
it,
management,
it's,
right?
It's yeah. manage. Yeah. You select manage, yeah. and that brings up that little tree, and among there is services.
Right.
And then as you scroll down, you'll see Windows Update Service, and so you just click the little stop button, and that stops it, and then install this update.
Yep. Nice. Very good.
But it was Chris Perillo and I thought, hey, I didn't know you could get to it that way. Very nice.
You can also, I think, Windows – I wonder if Windows X works on Windows 7. I think it might. Windows key X is the way to do it on Windows 10. It gives you a great menu of stuff. Question 5. Good morning. Good morning, Steve. In your episode, Flip Feng Shui, you mentioned that researchers flipped a bit in a public key, making it easily factored to find the private key. The problem is if you flip a bit in a public key, it's no longer a product of the private key. How would you then figure out what the private key was? So that's a good question.
It's a great question. And I, in my description of how this worked, I failed to explicitly note that what the flip feng shui guys had done. I explained how they deliberately caused the memory coalescence so that their process was sharing a memory page with the target process. And that they were then using the Rowhammer attack to flip a bit in where they knew was the private key. Okay, but what I didn't explain was that what that does is it flips the bit in both in the one copy that they both share. So in doing that, you have changed as Mr. Good Morning here notes, you've changed the key in the other process. So then in the attacking process, they perform the factorization of the modified key. They then extract the private key and immediately use it, like right now, to log in to the process being attacked using their private key. And it works because it's now being compared against the modified shared public key. And so in my description, I left out that like that final piece.
You should have told me. I've been trying to do this flip feng shui all week. Joey Bueno. Hey, Joey. Steve, could you check out Intel Security's True Key app? It's free and it leaves LastPass for dead. My question is, can we trust it? Could you please check it out and let the world know if it's okay to use it, or is it a spy?
So I thought, okay, this is interesting. No, I should find out what Intel's True Key is. So I dug in, and I didn't see anything special about it. It's free only for 15 passwords.
Oh,
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
With that.
Yeah, which is useful only as a trial, of course.
Right.
So not useful for any real use. Any real use costs $20 per year with an apparent maximum of 2,000 passwords.
What?
Well, okay, so that's a lot, but why have a maximum?
Right.
But that's what they say. The only hook that this has for appeal appears to be Intel's biometrics, which is really, you know, that's what they're actually trying to leverage is, you know, their camera and their scanners and so forth. And so that's okay, But biometrics are already built into mobile devices and will soon become standard options and features on probably, you know, probably everywhere. So, for example, by comparison, LastPass and even the Squirrel client for iOS already reprompt the user for their fingerprint confirmation when you use LastPass or Squirrel. So, you know, so Apple, as we know, made the API available so that apps could ask you to, you know, reassert your identity. I know, for example, the Amazon app on iOS does that too.
Yeah.
Which is nice because sometimes it asks like twice, and I have a pad that doesn't have the fingerprint reader, and now they're making me type in my password twice. It's like so annoying. But yeah.
Fingerprint's awesome. Course, let's get everybody. Let's just every, you know, just.
Yep.
We all have a phone now. Almost everybody should have a phone by now with a fingerprint reader on it.
Yep.
Apple in with OS X Sierra now lets you unlock your Mac using the fingerprint reader on your phone.
Nice. We're getting there.
A little catch 22 though. I thought, oh great, I'll set that up, and then it says, well, you have to have two-factor authentication on your iCloud account. I said, oh, that's great. I didn't even know they had that. They added that last version, El Capitan. So I was going to turn on two-factor authentication and said, okay, well, we've got your security questions right here. What was the name of your best friend in high school? I must have set these questions up 7 years ago.
And if you were smart,
you didn't use the real answer anyway.
Exactly. You used Joey Bueno.
I said Joey Bueno was. I remember him well. So I had no idea. So I call Apple to reset my security questions. And by the way, once you turn on two-factor, your security questions go away. Another good reason to use two-factor, because security questions are the worst idea in the history of security.
Yep.
So she reset my security questions, and I go back and it says, well, since you've changed your account, you can't turn on two-factor. First it said for 3 days. I understand that. 3 days would be fine. I understand that.
Yep.
Then it said 30 days. 3 days is so a hacker can't just kind of instantaneously reset all your stuff, give you a little time to notice. 30 days? Really, Apple? So now I'm completely insecure for 30 days?
Wow.
Wow. Fun Vacuum, not his real name. Well, maybe it is. I don't know. Shouldn't say. He might be Finnish. Squirrel. Squirrel, Steve. You may have already covered this. I'm on episode 564. I'm a little behind. Do you store a list of websites so we can automatically rekey for all sites?
That question comes up a lot, and the answer is I don't. It's not part of the spec. So what he's asking is, as we know, with Squirrel, you are able to securely rekey your existing Squirrel key if you have some reason to believe it's been compromised. So that's part of Squirrel's full life cycle key management. But it's incumbent upon you to go to the various sites and do that. So, and you can lock them to keep a bad guy from logging in as you until you're able to rekey. That's easy to do. Or with your rescue code, you are able to rekey and then prove your identity, which a bad guy is unable to do in order to get control back. So, you know, this all works. It's been proposed, and I have not put it into my client for a couple reasons. If it were there, then a bad guy who got your key would also get the list of all the sites where you have used it and where you visit and where he should go attack you. And that seems like a bad idea. Maybe it could be encrypted. I mean, if I had to solve the problem, I could. I could come up with a way that where it would be dynamically stored and only the rescue code could be used to decrypt it. Maybe somebody will want to do that. I sort of figure, first of all, the system is designed so that for you not to lose your key. And this is a secure recovery system. And all you have to do is go to the most important sites first and either shut them down until you get a new key or change the key. And then you can catch up with the less important ones over time. It basically, Squirrel always carries your old and your new key and is able to seamlessly update them. So it's really pretty easy. But I just don't – I don't really like the idea of trying to hold on to every site you've ever visited because it is a potential attack vector.
Christian Turi asks, you know, LastPass is now showing an alert if you have a Yahoo password in your LastPass vault. That's very nice. This prompted me to run the LastPass security challenge, which I'm sure you know what it is. Once the scan on all my passwords was finished, it showed a section of compromised accounts I should change passwords for. Among them were Yahoo and Dropbox, of course, totally expected. I was surprised to see my Amazon account there, too. Hadn't heard of any attacks on Amazon. Appears they've also had and informed some customers about it. I hadn't heard that either.
Yeah, I just wanted to share that. I love the fact that LastPass is doing that, and I would remind people from time to time, run that little security test that LastPass offers. You'll probably be a little bit surprised, and in this case, surprise is a good thing.
LastPass makes it easy, though, to fix the duplicated passwords, the bad passwords, to change the passwords.
And
just to follow up, Joe Segrist is still doing a great job there. The LogMeIn acquisition doesn't seem to have hurt LastPass. In fact, I think we have seen evidence of improvements. I think it's still usable, right?
Yep, I'm staying with it.
Yep, me too. We use it for enterprise, so we're kind of all in on it. Okay, three fun ones. You ready?
These are quickies, and then we're done.
MS Power user. Microsoft adds 24-bit color support to the Windows console. What? You the C prompt?
I love this. This is so good. This is and the show notes have a picture of the color palette that you can now present in the Windows console. And to me, this is okay. We have run out of actually useful things to do.
In their defense, it probably wasn't that hard to add, right?
What can we, we got to have a new version. Oh, my God. That's what we need. We need 24-bit color for the command prompt. Thank you very much.
And here's a tweet from Mikko Hipponen. Of course, we know him. We have him on Triangulation. He's the security guy.
I love this.
FProtect. He tweets, Yahoo's ad revenue is skyrocketing. As 500 million users log into Yahoo for the first time in years to change their password and log out. True.
Yes. True. How many eyeballs have seen those annoying ads? Yes.
I turn on two-factor, too, because they have that.
Okay.
I was just going to say, we talked about this last week. Better to do that than to delete your Yahoo account because you don't want somebody reusing your email.
Good point. And we did cover the problem of email account reuse. Right. Somebody was deleting them a long time ago, and it caused a lot of problems.
Yahoo. Ironically, Yahoo announced that if you don't use your email for a period of time, if you let it lie fallow, we'll recover your email address and use it again. So especially if you have an email address like I do that's your name at yahoo.com, you might want to just kind of keep it around. And every few months, I'm going to send and receive an email there so they think I'm still using
every mistake possible.
Couldn't be worse. Couldn't be worse.
And this last one, Leo, I just love it because it shows us that we are, in fact, getting up there in age.
Oh, my God. This must be I'll just read it. An anonymous listener says, here's an esoteric question. Do you know of any audio-based protocols or standards for transmitting ASCII symbols? Did old machines beep and chirp? Wow.
Isn't that great?
You think he's joking or he's serious?
I think he's serious, and I just love it. He's, probably doesn't know what
means.
Well, or what's a modem?
Or a modem.
Alex.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I just loved it. An audio-based protocol or standard for transmitting ASCII symbols.
There must be a way.
Yeah, there are a few of those.
But even going back to Samuel F. B. Morse, and they had those wires strung up along the Pony Express routes And he said, you know, we should really have some way of sending messages over those wires.
Yep.
And we'll make a dit 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 be an S and a da 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 be an O.
And dit, a dit, dit da.
Dit da.
Yep. I think that's A, isn't it?
Yeah, the E-T-A-I-O, you know, the first most used letters are the simplest.
Yes, so which was brilliant.
Brilliant.
Basically, it's sort of a form of Huffman coding. The ones you use most often are the shortest.
Yeah. His story is interesting. You know, he was a painter, a very, very, very good painter, shown in the salons of Europe in France. If you ever want to read Morse.
Really? Interesting.
Well, I only realized that when I'm looking at these great paintings from Samuel F. B. Morse and thinking, do you wonder if there's any relation to Morse code?
And did he do anything else of note?
I think so. I think he had quite the life.
Oh, cool.
So there must be a biography of Morse somewhere. But if you just look in the Wikipedia, you'll find some interesting stuff. That's our assignment for this week. Are you not doing any brain teasers anymore, or they just don't? They're hard to come by.
Yeah, they. If any present themselves, I absolutely will.
Because those were fun. I liked those.
Yeah, those were great. Yeah.
That would have been a good one. Does anybody know of any way to transmit ASCII characters in sound?
Yeah. Can you imagine the amount of effort and time that has gone into that over the years? You know, the sound of geese mating is what I always called, you know, the X dot. Yeah, exactly.
Is there a direct, I guess it's bits, right? It's ones and zeros, right?
Yeah. I mean, it started as two frequencies, of course. You know, frequency shift keying, FSK, and then as they kept pushing the standard further and further along, you got all kinds of fancy quadrature and much much more complex modulation of audio, to the point where, again, as an old timer, it's like, you can't put 56K through a phone line. What are you talking about?
Actually,
that's not possible.
Here we go. Here's your brain teaser.
Okay.
Is there a theoretical limit to the amount of data you can push down an analog copper wire? And we'll be back next week. And Leo will do some research. Because I have a feeling I'm going to have to. There is, actually.
I know the topic. Yeah. For next week.
Yes.
But I am embargoed. Yes.
So a surprise.
We have a big podcast next week.
Can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be a goodie.
Can't wait. Well, here's the deal. Come back here Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern in the P of M, post meridian. Or for those of you who are on a 24-hour clock, 2030 UTC, and you will find me and Steve jawing about security and all that stuff. You can also join us in the chat room, irc.twit.tv, as you watch or be in studio, too, like Nick did. He came up from Menlo Park to join us. He's a fan. Hi, Nick.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a seat out for you and a pair of headphones. And you can also, of course, watch after the fact. We make on-demand audio and video available. Steve's got the MP3 plus transcripts, which is really nice, available at his site, grc.com. And while you're there, don't forget to pick up SpinRite, world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility.
As the slogan for it says,
what is the slogan? Oh, it works.
It works.
It's a good slogan. Pithy. He has lots of other free stuff there, including his healthy sleep formula and perfect paper passwords. And you probably first discovered Steve, as many did, with Shields Up, which is still there, testing your shields, your router.
Yeah, it's funny. As this whole IoT thing has happened, there's been a real resurgence in people wanting to make sure, like, what's going on with their
router.
Is my router
working? Yeah.
Yeah.
We also have audio and video at our site, twit.tv/sn for Security Now. And you can find the show is a podcast, so you can find it everywhere podcasts are aggregated, like iTunes and Stitcher and Slacker and Google and everywhere else. We also have an Amazon Echo briefing. You know, we're on the Flash briefing. Steve sometimes is as well. A daily tech news headline. If you ever do your Amazon Echo Flash briefing, what you should do is go in the app and search for Twit and add us to it. It's not automated. It's real voices. Usually it's Jason Howell and Megan Maroney from TNT, but we also do bits from the other shows and so forth. That's for your Amazon Echo. Thank you, Stephen.
You know, you think about Shields Up. I was never able to scan more than that block of service ports because I developed it all when I was behind my two T1s. But I'm at level 3 now.
Ooh,
It might be time to do them all.
All 65,636?
Yeah.
Hmm. Why not? Yeah. I didn't know you didn't do them all. You just do the canonical 0 through 1024?
Actually, I go one line above. I think it's, I don't remember what the last port number is. But okay. I go a little bit past that because there was some reason once upon a time to do that.
Some port
and then I do, you know, the standard port scan or the full port scan, but those are only the service ports, which used back in the day, those were the ones where you'd be running services.
Right.
But these days in age, you're going to have a camera up at port 50,000.
Oh, I have stuff on all sorts of ports.
Yeah. Don't worry, buddy. I'm going to get Squirrel Finish first, and I'm going to get on.
Yeah, you're going to make people mad.
Yeah, they are. Oh, yeah.
You have a few things on your plate. You have a punch list now, Steve.
I do, but the good news is it's fully parameterized. When I rewrote it, it's just like I could just like tweak it a little bit and suddenly be scanning the entire port range.
See, that's smart.
And now I have the bandwidth, which I didn't used to have.
That's smart.
But now I won't do that soon. I promise. I'll get other stuff done.
You won't
first.
Be allowed.
No.
Thank you, Steve. You work hard enough on this show, by the way. Thank you for the hard work. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, my friend. Talk to you next week with a big story. Security.